Now we take you inside a rehabilitation program for Islamic militants that's been operating in Saudi Arabia since 2004. We learned 2 weeks ago that 9 former Saudi jihadists, some of them previously held at Guantanamo Bay, had been arrested for rejoining terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. This after their release from a highly respected rehabilitation program set up by the Saudi government. That number of terrorist recidivists has now grown to 12. In addition, another 11 are missing and presumed to be back at their old trade. So how does this model of rehabilitation work? Or not? Is it possible to reshape the ideas and religious beliefs of terrorists? If you have experience in this field, give us a call. We know there may not be many of you out there, but what works? What doesn't? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also weigh in on our blog at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Christopher Bosek studied the Saudi program for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
And I read that, the Saudi program enjoys something like 90% success, which in terms of other kinds of rehabilitation programs, it's pretty good. But nevertheless, with terrorists, one or two getting out, this could be very bad news.
Sure. And that's a very good point. And I think that's when we talk about recidivist or reoffense rates, it's important to keep separate people who go through rehabilitation in prison. In Saudi Arabia, domestic Saudi security offenders, people trying to go to Iraq, or people who come back from Iraq. For those programs, we look at a recidivist rate of approaching 5%, maybe 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from those are the Guantanamo returnees, and that's about 80%, 80% success rate, 20% recidivist reoffense rate.
Well, we'll talk about what doesn't work in a minute.
Yeah.
What is working? Many people look at the Saudi criminal justice system and don't think this is necessarily the place to set up a model rehabilitation program.
Sure. I mean, I think you could look at what goes on in the kingdom and think that this is kind of a very un-Saudi approach, or think that this is kind of a very enlightened thing that's going on in the kingdom. When in actuality, you see that what's going on in Saudi Arabia is kind of draws on these long-standing methods of Saudi conflict resolution and conflict management. It's all about co-optation and persuasion and coercion and getting people to drawing people on sides, really.
And what actually goes on? They've set up these special prisons. For one thing, they don't want these jihadists to be infecting, if you will, just regular criminals.
Sure. So, I mean, the shoe's kind of finally dropped. You need to segregate prisoners. And now security offenders, jihadis, are kept in separate prisons where they're segregated and can't communicate. And they're housed in 5 new specialty prisons that are designed to facilitate dialogue and rehabilitation. There's rehabilitation that takes place inside prisons, and typically, you know, this starts after the investigation or after the interrogation phase has ended. You sit down with a religious scholar, a sheikh, the first thing that happens is they say, why are you here and why are you in jail? And this is kind of starts off the dialogue process. The process is designed to draw you out in a conversation whereby the religious scholar will demonstrate that your understanding of Islam or the beliefs that you held or the actions you tried to justify are based on a corrupted version of your religion.
And try to convince the prisoner that he might want to reconsider his ways.
Sure, absolutely. And there are this typically can be done in short sessions for people who are kind of looking for a way out, people who kind of got unwittingly involved in extremism. Or you can be sent to a series of classes called long study sessions. So for 6 weeks, you take a series of 10 classes taught by religious scholars and psychologists and sheikhs. At the end of the course and at the end of the evaluations, you take an exam, and if you've passed the exam, then you move on to the next phase of rehabilitation.
And was the motivation to start this program the events of 9/11, where almost all of the hijackers were Saudis, or was it, in fact, more of a domestic problem where there has been recurring attacks within Saudi Arabia?
What we see in this rehabilitation program and the counseling program, it actually began after a series of domestic terrorist attacks in 2003, spring of 2003. What goes on in rehabilitation has earlier kind of precedence, and it was not uncommon and is still not uncommon in Saudi Arabia for religious officials to be involved in interrogations or questioning, kind of encourage you to get right with God and confess and make amends. Also, there's kind of been a long tradition of asking a village imam or a scholar to go visit a wayward relative in jail and kind of figure out how they got there in the first place.
How they tick. And part of what a lot of people say is, look, there's a network of friends and relatives and family that, well, all supported one way or another the decision of these young men to get involved in this in the first place. And if you're not addressing that network, you're not going to address the problem.
That's absolutely right. And one of the keys that of this program is that it doesn't just treat an individual. It treats someone's extended social network. So while you're incarcerated, you're no longer earning a salary. The government steps in to provide a stipend to your family. Your wife can't drive, obviously, in Saudi Arabia, so they will arrange for your children to get to school or your parents to get to hospital. What the government tries to do is anticipate problems that will arise in your being away, you're being held, and short-circuit that before it becomes a problem, recognizing that somebody else will come forward to help prisoners' families.
If the government does not.
Right, exactly.
In other words, the shadow network of terrorist organizations.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And this work, presumably, well, you were talking about the various kinds of recidivism rates, but someone who was a propagandist or a web designer for a terrorist organization might be somewhat more easily persuaded than somebody coming back from Guantanamo Bay.
That's a very good point. You know, there's a spectrum of offenders. There are people who are 100% committed, and there are people who are very tangentially connected with extremism and terrorism. The people who go through this program and are released are typically people who were, as you pointed out, propagandists, people who get caught with material, people who posted stuff to the internet, fundraisers, recruiters. They weren't people who were involved in violence. And these are the people that it's easier to deal with. So the figures look very, very good right now. When and if the Saudi government tries to put more difficult cases through, the figures will obviously get worse.
What is the goal here? Is the goal to change someone's fundamental beliefs, to get them to say, I was completely wrong, here are all my contacts, prosecute all these people, get them to change their ways too? Or is the goal to get these people to say, you know, I'm still angry about the things I was angry about, but I may not go blow things up?
I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, the goal is to get people to no longer act on their beliefs. I mean, this isn't about changing people's minds so much as it is about behavior modification. And there will always be people who maintain their beliefs. I mean, what research shows is that people who leave terrorist organizations or militant groups leave so for very personal reasons. You become personally troubled with what's going on, but you don't stop sympathizing with that organization.
With its ideology, but its actions.
Right. So what this program tries to do is demonstrate that you should no longer be acting on these beliefs. There are some people who go through rehabilitation and go through this program who are sort of born again religious in a new way, extreme in a new way. At the same time, there are also people who go through and recognize that, you know, going along gets me a lot more goodies than causing trouble.
We're talking with Christopher Bosek, a scholar in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who's written about the Saudi Arabian Rehabilitation Program for Jihadists. He's with us here in Studio 3A. If you have experience with this, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We should point out there are similar kinds of programs in many countries around the world, some of them based on the Saudi program, so there may be more people with some experience in this than we thought. Again, it's 800-989-8255. 898255, email talk@npr.org. Here's a call from Francis. Francis from Mount Shasta in California.
Oh, greetings from Mount Shasta.
Hi.
Greetings. Well, this particular town is the crossroads of many religious beliefs, and I'm a professor at the local college, retired government person. And something I found talking with the tourists and with the students is these people are very set in their ideas, and what I found is it makes no difference, Christian or Muslim, these people will not change, and if they hate another religion, whether it's a Christian hating a Muslim or another Christian or Muslims that don't seem to like anybody, especially the Jews, these hatreds are just so deep, I don't think it's possible for these to change. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Francis. He gets to a fundamental point. How easy is it to change religious beliefs?
No, I think this gets to kind of the heart of what this program and other programs are all about. You know, there are ways that you can demonstrate to people that it's in their interest to no longer act on their beliefs. There are ways through religious discussion and religious dialogue to show that, you know, the values that you held or the beliefs you held were incorrect. And what the Saudi program really tries to do is it says, you know, there are people who know the answers that you can listen to and the people who don't know the answers. And this program is not based on punishment or vengeance or retribution. It's about the government saying to you and your family, we know how you could have been misled or abused or tricked into doing this, right? The way in Saudi Arabia, terrorism, everybody's a victim of terrorism. the government, the victim, the perpetrator, we've all suffered. So they try to say, we want to pull you back to the fold. I think as you see that these programs, you know, proliferate and spread, what gets talked about is the rehabilitation that goes on in Saudi Arabia. But rehabilitation is part of a larger counterterrorism strategy. There are a whole series of prevention programs to keep you from getting into trouble, programs designed to undercut the ideological and the intellectual justifications for violence or extremism. Rehabilitation follows on after that.
It's also important to point out in Saudi Arabia, the government portrays itself as the religious authority. The king is not just the king of Saudi Arabia. He's the keeper of the two holy places.
And this is central, right? I mean, for everything that gets said about Wahhabism being puritanical and very strict and rigid, that's all very true. Wahhabism is also all about obedience and loyalty and recognition of authority. And these are the things that get stressed in this program, that there are people that you can listen to and who know, and there are people who aren't. And the state is in a position to say what they do know and what they don't know. In that sense, you know, it's kind of really remarkable that you have the Saudi government saying that we're going to enforce our version of Islam. I mean, this is exactly against, you know, kind of liberalism or broadening opinions. It's saying there is one way, and this is the one way that's acceptable and permissible.
Again, our guest is Christopher Bosek of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Nathan. Nathan with us from Salt Lake.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just got back from my second tour in Iraq about 7 or 8 months ago. My second time there, I was at Camp Buka in Iraq, which is an internment facility for security detainees is kind of the official title we used. While I was there, we started a program, kind of a re-education program, did a lot of things that you've been talking about. Had imams and scholars come in and talk with the detainees. We would send them to a school for a week or so, where they would just all day long, they would just be with everyone that was going through this kind of enlightenment type program. And kind of the crux of it was that a lot of the people we had there were very uneducated, couldn't even read. And so a lot of what we did, they had a school program to try to teach these guys how to read, so they could actually read the Quran themselves, rather than having somebody tell them, well, this is what it says and this is what it means. They started this program, or they started the very beginnings of the program, releasing people from there through this program right about the time that I got there. And at the time that I left, we were still claiming a very low recidivism rate, like less than 1%. I'm not sure how that continued after I left, but I think in a lot of cases, if you're very careful with the way that you deal with these guys, that they can be brought back out of it, at least in some of the mild and moderate cases. The extreme cases, which are the detainees that my company dealt with specifically, they were a little bit harder.
Sure.
To work with. We set up our compound. We had about 1,000 detainees in our compound, and they were all... they were all highly suspect of being Al-Qaeda or Jaish al-Mahdi. And those guys, they actually, we got some information through our intelligence system that indicated they were trying to act really good so we would send new guys into their compound, new guys being guys that had not been at Camp Buka, so they could recruit them.
Right.
Well, we were trying to be very careful at our level that we kept these guys segregated from everybody else. The Army still has a lot of room to work on in that regard. There was a lot of mixing of guys that were just kind of, hey, you know, somebody paid me to blow up a bomb next to an American convoy versus guys that were building the bombs and planning them. And
One of the questions, though, Nathan, that you raise by this description is, what else do you do with them? I mean, this is far preferable, one would think, to trying to just, warehouse these people forever and ever.
Warehousing them is really not a viable option. When I got there, we had around 22,000 detainees at Camp Buka. From my understanding, so it was the largest detention facility in the world. There were a lot of them there. And a lot of them, we started going through a process of having hearings with them and letting them come in and kind of give their side of the story. And we'd look through the file and what kind of evidence there was against them. And I sat on those boards. I'm a captain. And we had these three-member panels that would sit there and have these guys come in and talk to us. And a lot of them really, there wasn't a very good reason for them to be there. It really kind of came across as, you know, wrong place, wrong time. But unfortunately, they'd been put into this system and had been there. Some of them had been there for well over a year. I remember seeing them there two and a half years.
Yeah, well, let me get back to Christopher Bosek. And this system that Nathan is describing is in part based on the Saudi system, is it not?
It is. And as these programs proliferate, there's a real genealogy that you can see. What's going on with the Marine Corps in Iraq is based on Singapore. Singapore is based on Saudi Arabia. And you can see as these spread, there's kind of a DNA that you can follow. One of the points that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, and you see this in Saudi Arabia also, is that typically the people who go through this program have a very low level of knowledge about their own religion, people who didn't get it the first time around.
Right.
This is one of the reasons why the Saudi government argues that it works, that this is why we can teach these guys. They're a religiously motivated population. And when you're dealing with an extremist, it's like one of the only things you can talk about is religion, the only thing you can get through on.
Mm. Nathan, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And one of the things that we have to get back to, though, is, well, we have seen now something on the order of 24 recidivists. And this may be a very low rate, but this is a very serious problem if 24 people are rejoining groups like Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, the list that came out in the beginning of last week, the list of 85 most wanted suspects that the Saudis released, has 11 Al-Qaeda graduates of Guantanamo, people who've gone through the rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia and who have now believed to have rejoined Al-Qaeda in Yemen. This is obviously very troubling, right? And there are always going to be people who will lie and who will fail in rehabilitation. When we look at the people who have been arrested otherwise inside the kingdom, who have been rearrested, you know, it's now 12 individuals, six people who have been rearrested for associating with the wrong kinds of people, violating your parole. But also another three who tried to leave the country and three who were rearrested for getting ready to reoffend.
So not a perfect system, but an interesting program in Saudi Arabia. Christopher Bosek, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.